This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 147. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the word this week, Rob?
The word is drip is in pre-launch. I have 310 emails going out, and it's basically, you know, kind of a chunk of our launch list, and we're doing it as a test just to make sure that everything works, that all the sign-up and the trial emails and billing and all that stuff works. But it's pretty exciting. You know, I have a four-email launch sequence that I use often, and two of those emails have gone out, and so tomorrow is the email that actually lets people in and gets them to start using Drip. So it's kind of the first time that we're launching to a group of people rather than doing one-off stuff.
Yeah, that's really nice to see.
I want you to get audit shark here like next week or 2 weeks from now. That's where I want you to be.
Because I've been thinking a lot about how to deal with the issues for remediation. Just because doing things on an automated basis to like remediate them is kind of a scary thing. And I've actually been looking at putting together kind of a hybrid model where the software does some stuff and then on the back end, there isn't software that automates it, but I can go in and do things myself. So essentially have, you know, the software costs one price. And then if you want remediation in addition to that, I can charge you an additional fee on top of what the software costs, and we'll go in and manually take care of that. And I've got a couple of people who, you know, there's one guy who's really good at operations stuff. He's worked in a lot of larger production environments, and so have I. So either one of us could actually go in and make those fixes and understand the implications of all of the fixes that we're doing. And of course, that becomes something of a hybrid offering where you've got some software and some services. But I think that because it is a combined services and software offering, I can actually charge a significantly higher price to do that because people are going to understand, oh, well, here's the cost of the software. Here's the cost of the remediation effort beyond that. And it does bring up the price of the overall offering. I mean, you know as well as I do, when you first start launching a SaaS product, that the ramp up is going to be slow. And I think that adding in services like that is going to ramp up that revenue stream very, very quickly.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. For those who are listening, if you don't know what remediation means, AutoShark finds problems or could find security issues, and remediation means fixing those. But you're talking about doing some manual work where a person has to be involved, and you're right, it raises your price point, but it means you provide so much more value, because if you think about what auditing software probably does is it will add items to my to-do list, right, as a server owner. And this is the same problem I saw with Hittail. It's the same problem you see with a lot of apps. That will cause churn. Like, people feel guilty about it. They don't want to pay for something that is not actually fixing something. It's just telling them something needs to be fixed. There's a big difference between those two endpoints. And so, I mean, I'm doing it with Drip. We have a concierge service where we will write someone's entire email sequence for a fee. We did it with Hittail, where we automated the article publishing. We have writers who write articles for people to take that off their to-do list. It's adding, you know, human powering your SaaS app, basically, and it's taking it up the next level, both in price point and in the amount of service that you're able to offer. So yes, I fully support that. And there, I think this is the future trend, because so many of the low-hanging fruit SaaS apps are being built and they're done, right? How much more can you do with invoicing and accounting and these other things? I think that over the next few years, we're going to see these hybrid approaches, because most software developers don't want to do them because they're messy, right? We want everything to be code and we want everything to scale. And so adding that human-powered side to it, you just have such a chance to grow revenue faster and to offer so much more value, like exponentially more value to your end customers than you could just do with code.
I think the other significant advantage of doing something like this is the fact that you may not know up front what it's going to take to do all that remediation, at least for my product. I mean, there's obviously different problems that need to be solved for other products, but for those, there's going to be a different manual process in place, and you're not going to necessarily know how to handle that in every situation automatically. So you're going to have to go through those manual steps. You sometimes have to do things that just simply don't scale, and then once you get a handle on how to do them, then you try to automate them. And I think that this is just a natural extension of that, is to be able to do these manually, try and figure out what sorts of things are we going to regularly check to make sure we're not breaking other stuff, and then, you know, make those changes, test everything, make sure everything's still working, and figure out what those additional things are that need to be done to make sure it's still working, and automate those down the road.
If you have a SaaS app, you're thinking about one, ask yourself this question: what can I do to do more for my customers? Like what, even completely non-scalable requires manual labor. What can you do for them to provide them more value and therefore give you the ability to be better than your competition and to be able to charge more? And so you're going to have a higher revenue growth. So we both hired bookkeepers.
Yeah. How's yours going?
Mine's going really well. I've been happy with him. He has been doing all my Numa Group books for about 2 months, and he has me set up in Xero, which is xero.com. And I'm pleased with the software. It's easy enough to use. And finally, I'm not like dreading tax season next year because he actually went all the way back to January into Indonero, manually migrated my books. He charged me for it, which was fair. And then now he's upkeeping it on, you know, a monthly basis. How about you?
Yeah, my bookkeeper's been really working out as well. She came in, I think she was just here yesterday, and worked through the rest of the stuff, like all the bills and stuff that I had to pay for the month, and I just walked her through the process. So far, it's working out great. I mean, it was really nice to just hand her everything and just kind of walk away and say, let me know if you have questions. And I just didn't even have to think about it. It was awesome.
Yeah, it's definitely a weight off my shoulders. It was reasonably easy when Indonero worked, but once it started having bugs, I was spending a lot of time on it, and so it's nice to know that it's taken care of. It's like too expensive to outsource, in my opinion, when you have good software that can do it, or if you have a simple solution. You know, if you have a pretty simple scenario where you have one product that's generating revenue, I would recommend using Outright, and you can probably do it almost completely automated. If you set up a few rules, even with Xero, you can set up a lot of rules, and you can probably mostly automate it and don't need a bookkeeper, but it's once you get more complex, or I think like you, Mike, you have a lot of paper that you process. That's the point where you just, your time is more valuable than sitting there, you know, you're doing something basically that's not pushing your business forward. Hey, we have two new product launches over the past couple weeks from longtime Micropreneur Academy members. The first is Ivan, or Yvonne, I think he actually pronounced it. He not only launched his split testing plugin for WordPress, but he saw his first sale within a day or two of launching, and that's at abpressoptimizer.com. And he gave us a coupon code for our listeners. If you use startups25, that'll get you 25% off. And he dropped us a little note. He said, "The Micropreneur Academy gave me a realistic outlook and the tools I needed to launch my first product. Having the support of the Academy community gave me the motivation to finish my product and made me accountable for my progress." He says, "Out of everything I've built in my career, nothing has been as gratifying as when I got that email for the first sale." So definitely congratulations to Yvonne. The other launch is Nitesh Singh, also a lot. It's been with the Academy for several years, and he launched auctionplugin.net. It's also a WordPress plugin. It enables you to launch an auction site in a few minutes.
You know, I'm seeing a lot of people go into the WordPress space and launching a lot of different plugins. A
lot of opportunity there. And it's like, you know, we've talked about on the podcast now for the past, 6 months of kind of getting that early win, because these are the first products that these guys are launching. And it's, you launch it and you get, you know, even if it's a few hundred a month, a few thousand a month, like it shows you that you're capable of it. It gives you that early win. It gives you confidence. And it also teaches you a lot about the different elements that you need to then grow, you know, into a kind of a more, maybe a more complex app or a complex market. And it's that stair-step approach, right? Of starting small and kind of moving up. I think it's really cool.
I think what I find really interesting is that I've seen some people launching these WordPress plugins and they don't know anything about WordPress development. They're essentially outsourcing the entire thing to other people. And then they're simply, you know, attacking the marketing side of things to understand how to sell it, how to, you know, put the site up and everything else, and really focusing on the marketing and letting somebody else deal with all the code behind it. Even though they are developers and they could theoretically figure it out if they wanted to, but they're just not.
Right. And I mean, I think that's the nice benefit of something like a WordPress plugin over SaaS, is that it's so much less complex that you can hire a developer and more easily outsource it. There also are a lot of decent WordPress plugin developers around, and they're not super expensive. Again, building a SaaS app can take, you know, 4 to 6 months of pretty heavy development, whereas you can get a plugin developed in a month, and kind of what you see is what you get. There's just a lot fewer moving parts, and I maintain that right now it's still a good strategy for someone just getting started. Today we are going to be answering some listener questions going into the backlog. Our first listener question is a voicemail about the best pricing strategy for a B2B SaaS app.
Hey, my name is Dan, and I am representing ChartBreeze. That's chartbreeze.com. It's charting for your Trello project. And I want to know, what's the right strategy to take when trying to price your SaaS project, and specifically when trying to price for potential businesses to buy your product, not necessarily consumers? Thanks. I'll listen to your answer. Bye-bye.
So I think Dan really has two questions. The first part, he's asking kind of what's a general approach for it, but I bet he also may appreciate some advice about his site specifically, which he said is at chartbreeze.com. In terms of general SaaS pricing, I mean, I think almost all SaaS apps are going to be business to business. There are very few B2C SaaS apps that I've seen that actually work, because consumers don't really love subscriptions. So I think in general, when you are talking about SaaS pricing, just assume that it's B2B. There are a bunch of different approaches you can take. I think that I always like to price on value, meaning that if it saves someone money or makes them money or saves them time, then you can somehow justify the price that way. Now, I know there's argument about whether or not that kind of pricing actually works, but it helps at least shape the thought. Whether you use that in your marketing or not, it helps at least shape it in your mind of what could this potentially be worth to someone. The second approach that I think about is like gut feeling of what would I be willing to pay. And I will also ask a handful of people what they think it would be worth. You run the risk, if you're trying to both do customer development and develop the product, as well as ask them about what they should pay, then you kind of have two conflicting things going on, right? So you can't do that. I feel like you need to figure out your feature set first and figure out what solves a real pain point and start building that. And then ask a separate group of people, here's what I'm building, would you buy it? And how much would you pay? And then once you get a number that you start feeling comfortable with, like, it seems about like $29, you know, $29 a month might be a low end number. Then go to this, back to the first group and say, all right, I've solved your problem and I'm going to charge $29 for it. Are you good with it? And then you're going to see reactions all over the board, right? Some people say that's a no brainer. And some people will say, oh, it's way too much. And then try to figure out what is the difference between those guys. Like, are they both SaaS companies buying your app? And is one of them just has, you know, makes so much more per lead, and so they're willing to pay more for it? Or try to figure out the point at which you can segment. And that's the trick, right? It's figuring out, is it the number of emails sent per month, or the number of subscribers that they have, or the number of documents they upload? There's these things to pivot on, and you've really got to dig in to start figuring that out. It's not a trivial process. There's been a lot written on this. I actually like 16ventures.com, which is Lincoln Murphy's site, and he's written a lot about SaaS pricing. So if you want to go deeper, I would definitely check out 16ventures.com.
I think for ChartBreeze, one of the things that strikes me is that the Plus plan, for example, is listed at $29 a month. And for anyone who's not looking at it, there's Basic, Plus, and then Enterprise, priced at $9, $29, and then $59. And if you look at Business Class Trello, it's $25 a month or $200 a year. So to me, it seems a little odd to charge more for an add-on than for the product itself.
Got it. And for people, yeah, ChartBreeze is charts for Trello. It says create gorgeous charts for your Trello boards.
You know, the Trello business class only costs $200 a year. So to me, it seems a little odd to charge more for charting capability than it does for the product itself. It's not to say you can't pull it off. The other end of the spectrum is that you also have to understand that this is being built on a product that could theoretically be free. So, you know, people could be using the free version. And I have a hard time coming up with a pricing plan that is an add-on for something that's, you know, theoretically free. You can kind of look back at like WordPress and say, well, that's free. And, you know, you're paying for the plugins that extend the functionality. And that's one way to look at it. I don't know with ChartBreeze how you would justify that. I really think that you need to start digging and find out what people are using it for, and then try to come up with a pricing scenario that makes sense for the problems that they're trying to solve. The other thing you could do is find ways that people are using Trello and build something around that, such that your add-on product really addresses those needs in a way that leverages the Trello backend and uses your front end. And then essentially what you're doing is you're using the Trello engine to power your application as a value add.
Yeah, I think ChartBreeze doesn't really have a pricing problem. I think it has more of a value proposition problem, because I use Trello and I have now several Trello boards that I'm using to manage some different things, but I don't know why I would use ChartBreeze. The homepage headline says Trello plus charts, So that's what it is, not, you know, not what it does for me. And then it says create gorgeous charts from your Trello boards. My next question is, okay, but why? So then there's three benefits listed on the homepage. It's see the bigger picture, work smarter, not harder, and clearly communicate victories. But none of those really apply to me, or they feel so vague that I don't understand. I almost need like a case study, like or multiple case studies of specifically how would I use this? How is it going to save me time, make me money, or save me money? That's really what I want to know when I come here as a business.
And that's kind of why I was pointing to finding out what people are using it for and then building a front end that is going to leverage the Trello back end to specifically solve those problems and use it as the value add. Because obviously you could use Trello for, I'll say bug tracking if you really wanted to, but you know, is it really set up for that? And the answer is no, but could you build a front end that would leverage that Trello back end using the APIs and make it into a great drag and drop bug tracker? And you probably could. So those are the things that I'm thinking of that would probably be applicable. But I think it goes right to the heart of the matter of what you just said is, why would I use this? I don't know why anyone would want to chart things in Trello. And I think it really depends a lot on what they're actually using Trello for.
Right. And so if it's only software development companies that are doing agile development using Trello, then that's it. You know, ChartBreeze becomes, you want agile development. Are you a developer? You want all of that verbiage and you want to tightly niche it to them. If it turns out that realtors want charts, because I know there's a, you know, a contingent of realtors who are using it, then boom, that's what ChartBreeze becomes, the realtors Trello charting app. So I think there's more digging to be done here to really find out the value prop that you're offering very, very specifically, boil down into one sentence, and to find out the audience that needs that the most. And if you don't know that yet, that's okay. You just have to do some digging and continue to look for it. Because I think at this point, if you launch with this app, I don't know if you've already launched, I don't think you have a pricing problem. I think you have, like I said, a value prop problem, and you need to dig deeper to find that before you're going to be able to really start attracting customers and solving a deep pain point. So thanks for the question, Dan. Our next question comes in from Brandon Crockett. He says, hey, Mike and Rob, my partners and I have been listening to your podcast for a while now and find it very informing. Our company is called Qdaptive, web-based, truly adaptive question generating app that uses class notes to generate study material. Our question is, what do you recommend for a small business checking account? We have an LLC formed and we are finding tons of fees associated with the business accounts. Do you have any recommendation for us?
Having recently gone through this process of finding a new bank for my businesses, I'll give you the one that I think is probably the best for anyone who's starting out and they're essentially in a pre-revenue state. Look for local credit unions. And the reason I say that is because if you go to any of the big box banks like Bank of America or Wells Fargo, what's going to happen is you're going to sign up with them and get an account with them. But the problem is that because you're not carrying a large balance, they're going to start charging you monthly fees. And those fees can be anywhere from $15 to $30 a month. And if you don't want to be charged those fees, then you have to carry this minimum balance, which is probably in the neighborhood of $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. Now, when you go to a smaller bank, those smaller banks probably have a little bit more flexibility, but it's really the credit unions where you can start to leverage their business banking side, which they don't necessarily concentrate on. The smaller credit unions concentrate on consumers, but they do offer business banking accounts. So, for example, near me, there's a bank called DCU, and they're a digital federal credit union, but they have a lot of business services, and they actually have some substantial backing on the business side because they take all the stuff that they offer their members and also offer them to businesses because many of their members own businesses. So in order to offer their members more options in terms of banking, they said, well, let's offer these to our members who own businesses as well. And they've kind of grown that, so they will offer stuff to a business even if you don't have personal accounts with them. But because it's a digital credit union, they are trying to move everything online. So for someone like me, that works out really, really well. But you can leverage that too. You go to a local credit union, find out what sorts of business options they have. I did a search in Massachusetts and found, you know, half a dozen credit unions that offer business banking, and almost all of them were no fee. Almost all of them did not have a monthly minimum that you had to maintain. $5 is a small price to pay to be able to get that business banking account and not have to pay any fees.
Yeah, I was going to answer this with a B of A account. I'm not a huge fan of B of A, but they do have nice online banking, and you can deposit checks through their mobile app. And I don't pay any fees on any of my accounts, but then you pointed out that it's because I keep a minimum balance. So when you're first starting out, you're right. A big bank is always going to charge you fees until you get to that point of having whatever their minimum balance is, typically $10,000 to $20,000 for a business checking account in order not to pay the fee.
Thanks for the question, Bren. Hope that helps.
Our next question is from Sean Wahlberg about segmenting customers. He says, "Hey, Rob and Mike, I enjoy your podcast each week. Thanks for taking the time to share your experiences. I created a tool over at isithacked.com that checks a website for hard-to-find spam, and it's been doing a great job at catching infections that other tools have missed. People have been asking me to add a subscription feature that will notify them automatically rather than having to go to my site to check their own sites. I'm not sure how I should build pricing plans to segment my potential customers. I'd like to have some way of making the product available to micropreneurs, but also make sure I have higher-priced plans that cater to larger customers. Any guidance you could offer would be appreciated."
There's two different ways that I can see of kind of segmenting the market. And the first one would be for those people who only have a limited number of either websites or servers. I don't think it would actually be all that difficult to figure out whether or not somebody has one website on the same server or 15 different websites on the same server. What I think you're going to have to deal with is if somebody has 10 websites, are they a large business or are they a small business? You know, it could fall either way. And I think that that's going to be the challenging part, is trying to figure out whether or not they fall into a more of a higher tier business plan versus somebody who just has five or six small products that they're trying to work. And they happen to all be on the same server, but they're, you know, just trying to figure out what is going to work for them and what's not. And then, you know, they just throw away the other ones, because the problem that they're going to have is that even if they're making a fair amount of money from one of their products, maybe let's say it's $500 or $1,000 a month, and the rest of them are making almost zero, you still want those other ones protected if they're on the same server, because if something gets onto one website, it could theoretically cross-infect all the other ones or infect the entire server. So you may need to do a little bit of legwork on an individual customer basis and set up pricing tiers to say, okay, well, based on this number of servers or this number of websites, you know, you're going to end up in a different tier. You can also combine those a little bit and say, you know, one server or up to five websites, and kind of say that they're the same thing. I think WP Engine talked a little bit about, in a podcast I heard, about how they segmented their customers, and they realized that if somebody had 10 websites, chances were really good that only two or three of them had a lot of traffic and the rest of them had virtually none. And that applied primarily to bloggers, but it has to do with the distribution of how those are spread out. Another way that I can think of to segment the market a little bit is to identify how many times you're going to hit their website in either a day or a week or a month to say, okay, we're going to check it on this time period to see if it's been hacked or not. And most businesses are going to say, well, I want to know at least once a day, or maybe I want to know every hour, because I want to make sure that website or the web server isn't getting hacked. And if it is, I want to know immediately, versus somebody who's just doing it on a more casual basis, once a day or once a week is probably fine for them, especially if they're not making any money from it. So those are kind of my thoughts on how to monetize the site.
Yeah, I think those are all good thoughts on it. The other thing I would look at is I would go to pingdom.com and look at their pricing, and I go to Sucuri. It's Sucuri.net, because these are related services. Pingdom checks your uptime and some other stuff, frankly, and then Sucuri is malware detection, alerting, and cleanup for websites. And so they're more of a competitor for you. And I imagine when you said that you pick up stuff that others don't, it might be Sucuri who's not, because I think they're kind of the leader. And if you look at how they do it, they say one website is $90 a year, 2 to 5 is $190 a year, and then 6 to 10 is $290 a year. And they kind of do all inclusive plans. I think this is a reasonable way to, you could think about having a one website. If you really want to, you know, help out micropreneurs, you could have a one website tier that's a little cheaper. And then as you get more websites, realize, well, they probably have, you know, more revenue. And so kind of increase the pricing accordingly as they go up in bulk. As an enterprise that has, you know, many websites, should be paying more. The other thing, but there are all these things, like Mike said, you can pivot on, and Pingdom has them as well. It's like, do you get how many SMS alerts do you get? How many email alerts? You know, do you have multi-user capabilities? Because if you want multiple users to log in, you have a team of people, then you should definitely be paying more. And these are things you probably don't have built yet and may just be on your feature list, but those are ways to start segmenting your audience. The other thing is, if you start doing integrations with anything, whether it's reporting, pulling in data or pushing data out, that in order to use your API, you can move that into a middle tier or a higher tier, because just the basic person who simply wants the basic scans, might be willing to forego that in order to pay a lower price. So good question, Sean. Thanks for sending that in. I also like the website, I have to admit. I think he did a good job here, because he has the headline is it hacked? ? And then you can enter a URL and they'll take a look to see if it's hacked. And then below that, he has, want to know more about keeping your site safe? Subscribe to our mailing list. And I bet by now he has a decent mailing list of people that when he does go to launch a SaaS version or a subscription version of this, he actually has a head start. If he hadn't had that in, I mean, you basically have, you're starting from scratch. And even though your site's been up all this time, you don't have an asset. So he's really, even though he's basically doing a free model at this point, Sean is still getting something out of having this site live. He's basically building a list of people who may be interested in his subscription service down the line.
The other thing I can think of is that this type of service, just in general, I think, is aimed more at businesses than it is at consumers anyway. So I would think that most people are going to be willing to pay for it. And I almost feel in many ways that if you start down the road of looking at security, then chances are good that, for somebody to be interested in paying for security, they have to have something that they're willing to protect or that is on the line that they want to protect. So once you get to that point, chances are good that you probably have money to spend on that anyway. So I don't know as I would worry too much about the pricing. I understand if you want to try and give back to the community, and there are certainly ways to do that. I mean, you put up regular pricing plans, and then after that, underneath, you can say, are you a single founder or do you run a small business with, one employee? Click here and let us know, and we'll work with you on special pricing or something along those lines.
Our next question is about building a SaaS app for a client and turning it into a product. It comes from longtime listener Scott Underwood, who has emailed before. He says, I have a client who requested a proposal for a web app. I have a feeling the bid to develop the app will be higher than he's expecting. It's in a niche that I think I might have some promise to market the app as a SaaS app. The client has three similar businesses that he would like the app customized for. The apps would be similar, but would apply to three distinct business types. So I think it would appeal to a wide market and could be further customized for other similar businesses. My thoughts on how to work this out are, number one, provide the client with a proposal to create the app for a fixed fee with a monthly maintenance fee, and I would retain the intellectual property rights to use the code, to resell it, create a SaaS app, etc. Option number two, offer to create a SaaS app, providing him with the functionality he needs, and he can be customer number one. I would require him to commit to a minimum 12-month subscription paid monthly, so he has an initial lower upfront cost, and I have a customer for 12 months. I would also utilize his input and his industry knowledge to improve the app by getting feedback from him and his employees. And option three, try to get an initial payment of 50% of his first year subscription and then give him 50% off the monthly fee for the first 12 months. There are only one or two similar SaaS apps out there in the space, and they're dated, so there is room for improvement. The price points for plans are $99 minimum for one location, $600 average for six locations, and a high end of about $1,000 a month for 10 locations. I don't have industry experience in these businesses, but the initial client could provide a lot of feature requests and improvement so that the app provides more value. I've emailed 10 similar businesses to get their feedback on whether they would be interested in it, benefit from, and subscribe to this web application. I'm leaning towards option two, where he agrees to subscribe for 1 year minimum to the app. The app isn't overly complex, so I think it's something I could create the initial version of in a reasonable amount of time to get him up and running, and then use his monthly payments to cover improving the app over time. Looking forward to hearing your thoughts.
I think the first thought that comes to mind for me is that in your question, there are a couple of different ways that you're trying to get the customer on and committing them to 12 months and paying you on a monthly basis. And I would think that if this customer really has three different businesses that they're trying to get this application built for, then it would probably make a lot more sense to charge them upfront a yearly fee for the entire thing. And that way you don't have to worry about monthly recurring payments, that collections process. You don't have to worry about it. It makes things a little bit easier. You could probably just get them to cut you a check and be done with it. And that does alleviate a lot of the issues with providing them with a price quote that's going to be well outside of their price range. And I think that I would first go to them and say flat out, look, I think this price quote is going to be far outside of your price range. What do you think of this as an option? And let's kind of talk through that. So you can kind of float that to them without bringing together a full blown proposal, and that's probably where I would start. In terms of going through and actually making it work, though, I would definitely just try and get them to pay the 12 months and commit upfront to the whole thing. And the problem you're going to run into that you and the customer are going to need to decide on is, when does that time period start? When does that day one of that 12-month contract start? Because there are going to be a lot of things that you do that you're going to try and put these things into the program, and you're just not going to have time for all of it on day one. So there's going to have to be a line in the sand that you draw to say, look, at this point, we're going to pull the trigger, and this is when the time period is going to start. Otherwise, you're going to run into problems down the road as to when the customer thinks that the time should start versus when you think it should start. And you may want to go down the road of having a deadline set at some point. So let's say, right now it's August. Let's say you decide December 1st. That's when you're going to pull the trigger, and that's when the time period is going to start. And at some point before then, you collect the 12 months. So those are my thoughts on it. But like I said, I would lean towards that initial 12-month subscription and try and get them to just pay all of it up front. And then you can, provide them a yearly plan from then on.
Yeah, my initial thought is this is complicated. And while I don't think it's a bad idea, I think it's a last resort. And then if you could possibly fund this yourself or do it in off hours, it's just going to be easier. It's going to be less complicated. Because while you're not technically taking on a partner who has equity, you are going to have someone who maybe thinks that they can dictate every aspect of the app. What if they request a feature and you don't want to build it? It doesn't apply to anyone else. It takes a long time to build it. There are a lot of potential conflicts that could come up here. And so I think dealing with the right partner who has an open mind and is willing to work with you on this and is pretty easy to deal with, I think this is realistic. But I think if that person is demanding and or entitled and, thinks that by paying you, an upfront payment of, say, $600 a month, it's about $7,000 for an annual, if they think that they can suddenly dictate every aspect of your app that, would have otherwise cost them $50,000 to build, then that's a real problem, because it's gonna sideline you. It's gonna cost you a lot of time and potentially, a lot of money. If you think about it, building this app, it will be good to have this person's input because they do have the industry knowledge. But frankly, marketing it and trying to find that next market, because if you build three versions, I don't know if you're gonna own all three of those. How you're possibly gonna market all three of those? That's the real concern. That is an enormous amount of time. If they really are SaaS apps that need full-on kind of marketing and scaling and all that, it's not something that one person could easily do. So,
well, I think what he's trying to do is solving the same problem for three different businesses, and it's just he's charging the person for three different subscriptions.
Yeah, that is a thing. You would need to charge for three subscriptions, because although you may not have to write the code three times, you are going to have to support three different apps, three different installations, three different deployments, all that stuff. If your client thinks that he can basically pay once and then get three versions out of it, I think that's another thing to think about, is that there's always a lot more with having three apps than just writing that shared code base. So in general, I'm not wild about this idea. I don't think it's terrible, but it's not an ideal situation. It's not a scenario I personally would embark upon.
Would you be more comfortable with it if he built the whole thing first and then, basically worked through the issues with the person and then said, okay, if this meets your needs, then I'll charge you for those? Because it seems like that's really the sticky issue, is getting the customer involved so early on that they feel like they're involved in the development effort and it's really being customized for their environment.
That's right. That's my big concern, is that you have kind of a marriage there that needs to be well defined as to what their role is and your role is and the specific ownership and who can dictate what gets into the product. Because if stuff goes down in the middle and they request a feature and you say, no, we're not going to build it, and they get really upset about it, then what are you going to do? How do you resolve that? So thanks for the question, Scott. Okay, and our last question today comes from Brian Donahue. He says, hi guys, I'm a newbie Academy member and I attended my first MicroConf in April. I was very glad I was able to attend. There was one idea that was espoused repeatedly that I'm struggling to understand how to put into practice. The idea that you should sell your product before you've written any code. That sounds great, but gives me all kinds of anxiety just thinking about it. I'm wondering how this looks in practice. What is the sales pitch? What promises do you make? Are you promising a delivery/launch schedule? If they actually give you their credit card and you take their money, how long can you reasonably wait before they have something usable? If you have any experience or stories you can relate about how this was done successfully, what things need to be in place, and how the pre-launch customers engage in and get value from the process, I think that would make for a great show. Or if there's some info you can point to me that I've missed that explains this in more specifics, I'd love to find it. Thanks again for all your hard work. It's hugely inspirational.
I think that one of the things that you have to keep in mind when you're asking people for money or you're asking them to commit, it's not necessarily that you're asking them for the money. It's asking them for a commitment to, you know, at least give the product a fair shot. And when push comes to shove and you've delivered the product and you've handed it to them, put it in front of them and said, hey, this is what I've built. Let me know what your thoughts are. Is this something you're willing to pay for? And that's really what you're trying to get. You're trying to get that commitment. It's not about the money. I mean, that money could be a dollar. It could be a down payment on a house. You know, the actual dollar amount in some cases is somewhat immaterial. What you really just want is them to give it a fair shot and be in enough pain that they are willing to come back to your site later on based on an email to actually follow through and sign up. And that's what you want. You want that commitment. It's not about the dollars. It's not about, you know, them saying, you know, yeah, I want this and I want it in 3 weeks or 3 months. Chances are really good that if they have this problem now, they're still going to have this problem in 3 months. They're still probably going to have this problem in 6 months. And depending on how painful that is, if the problem is so incredibly painful that they need a solution immediately, there are going to be other people out there like them. So I don't know as I would worry too much about them finding another solution, because if they do find another solution, that's market validation for you. It means that there are other products in the market that are solving that problem, and you're going to be able to carve out a space for yourself in that market.
I think Brian's talking about, a few people pointed out, you know, that you should actually get a credit card and charge their card or get a check from them maybe and don't cash it as a true commitment, that until you have that, you don't have a true commitment that they actually are gonna value what you're building. And I've never done that. And I don't think it's necessary. I do think that it's probably better, or I know it's better than getting a list of emails, but I find that asking someone for a purchase commitment up front before you've built it will if you do it on a landing page as an example, it will substantially reduce the number of people who you're actually going to be able to engage with later on, because you have to really sell hard on that page in order to get them to put their credit card number in. Whereas if you promise what the app is going to do and then you get email addresses, you then have a way to contact them and a way to explain what you're doing and give them updates and get buy-in on the process and hopefully convert them by engaging with them over time and showing them what it is you're building. So if I was going to do it solely online, that is definitely how I would do it. That's how I've done drip. And for an example of that, you can go to getdrip.com right now. You can see the landing page, and that's the promise that I make to people. That's how I sell before coding. On the flip side, I do know that there are people who cold call or get in face-to-face conversations and then do actually ask for the credit card. I think that if that feels odd to you, if it feels scary, then maybe don't do it this time around and wait until you have your legs under you, wait until you have an app that you've launched, you feel more confident about it, and consider it at that point. I don't think that there is only one right answer to this question. I don't think that the end-all be-all way of doing it is to always get credit cards, because I think it limits the number of people. It not only limits the number of people who you can kind of get into your early access, but it means you really have to flesh out early on exactly what you're building. Because if you explain kind of a vision or a value prop, it's hard to get someone to write a check for the first month or the first 6 months of that. It's really hard. But once you have something to show them, then you can say, all right, does this do it? And how can I change it so that it does provide you with the value to write that first check? There's a range here of things you can do. And what you feel comfortable with is probably what's going to work best for you. And I do think that multiple options are viable here. If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. See you next time.